Well, there's a blue sky in Donegal today, and there's big trucks on the road outside. I'm sitting in my little house, writing me book, and I'm happy you're here. You're welcome. It's the first day of December in 2023. It's the beginning of the Christmas season. A woman told me this morning that it's only on the 6th of January that traditionally they used to put up the Christmas tree. I didn't know that. I imagine it's like the 6th would be just before the 7th, and the 7th would be the eve of the Feast of Our Lady. And I guess that's why. You wouldn't actually put it up on the 7th, because the 7th is the eve, and that's like important in itself, you know. But you do it on the day before and everything is ready. And on the vigil, on the eve of the great feast of Mary, the Immaculate Mother, begins the feast. And everybody goes to Dublin from the country. It was the day that traditionally everybody went shopping. So, I had a decision to make. I thought, what'll I do for December? And I felt what I'll start with is some stories, because maybe in the past few weeks I have been very focused on my own personal faith. And sometimes it's nice just to dilute that intensity and go back to sharing stories with you. I'll read you a little meditation I wrote a long time ago, maybe 8 years ago. I'm talking about Jasnagora. Jasnagora is a monastery in Poland. I saw a few crutches in the monastery of Jasnagora. I saw no gaudy wall of hanging bandages, arm slings or prosthetic limbs to tell the world that miracles of a personal kind have happened here. The Black Madonna of Częstochowa is not a woman who does small wonders. Her concerns are on a grander scale. The Madonna is an ancient icon, Byzantine in style, which hangs above a small altar in a quiet oratory just off the main basilica. Her dark features are covered with a silver facade, so that only the face and eyes gaze out at the people who stand in awe before her. Couples in love, old men tasting widowhood, young nuns in search of ecstasy, pregnant women and old grandparents come and stand or kneel, and I presume pray for their individual dreams and hopes to be fulfilled. My therapist is not against prayer. She told me once that my own mother's lack of physical intimacy with me at an early age could be the cause of my melancholy. She suggested that life in infancy without the tenderness of a mother can be traumatic, and the wound can fester through life and cause problems in late middle age when the prospect of death becomes more real. My therapist often explains to me that it's good to be mothered, and in fact sometimes in the dark of night, when there is no one else to offer comfort, it is even possible for me to become mother to my own interior child. And through therapy, I have learned to stop saying I must be tough with the world and hard on myself. I realize now that such self-loathing was what led me into darkness. So for me, the Black Madonna of Częstochowa in Poland is a very potent and tender image. And she is real, insofar as the beautiful Byzantine icon actually exists above the altar, in the real world, as a monumental presence that is not a figment of my imagination, but a cornerstone of Polish history. Ever since the icon was placed in the monastery on the hill above the town, back in the 14th century, surrounded by high walls that even the cannonballs of enemy armies couldn't penetrate, and ever since John II Casimir, King of Poland, made her queen of his kingdom in 1656, the Black Madonna has had a political role. She's not just Queen of Heaven, but of Poland itself. She is the sovereign icon of an entire nation. So it was no surprise that Karol Wojtyła's visit to Częstochowa soon after his rise to the papacy frightened the Soviet Union and the communist leadership in Poland, frightened them out of their wits. I suppose it dawned on the new pope that to invoke the blessing of the Black Madonna might tip the balance of power in favour of his nation's freedom and future at a time of crisis when solidarity was facing down the old regime. In the monastery of Częstochowa, I always feel a great sense of human dignity. It's apparent in the pilgrims' private rituals. It's apparent in the Madonna's inscrutable gaze. And I sense the same human longing that stirs in the music of Goreschki and Penderecki, present here too, in the whispered sighs and songs of the pilgrims on their knees. I feel that the heart of the icon, to paraphrase Yeats, the heart of the icon is beating. And I don't care anymore when my friends tease me about such innocence or try to uncouple me from the delusion that some great mother in the sky is holding us, or that some heaven beyond this world is waiting for us. Because I know as well as anyone that there is only silence beyond the grave. But faith is an act of the imagination. It offers us an alternative way of seeing things, a perception that allows us live calmly in this lifetime and find happiness in the present moment. And the eyes of the icon are extraordinary, in the way that the eyes of the Mona Lisa are. They sear the soul with a template of human compassion. The Madonna's eyes awaken in me a child who is still loved and has permission to love, even if that is a myth surrounded by a universe of desolation. I need no cures here. There are no cures for human isolation. But the very act of being in the present moment in heaven is enough. Her sorrowful face gazes at me with pity and compassion, and a new child is born in me again every time I look into her eyes. Now, God, I was in a dark place. It was 14 years ago. But I also feel that when I read that back, I can hear myself hoping, you know. I can hear myself praying. I suppose I was a bit surprised in it where, you know, I said there is nothing in life but the darkness. There is nothing beyond the grave but death. And I think I used to feel that was the case because I felt so much in depression and despair at that time. But you see, what I think got me through the depression was that I was defiantly thinking of something else. So if I take now the idea of, let's say, the resurrection of the body, and life eternal. It completely defies physics. It defies the logical world, the realm that I live in. And yet that defiance, that kind of stubborn faith, is what keeps me going. There's a song, "Hard Times Come Again No More," and the refrain is, "Hard times come again no more." But you sing it when you're in suffering. You sing it when you're in pain. You sing it when you're down. And you sing, "Hard times come again no more." And everything logical tells you, well, the hard times will come. You never get out of the hard times. The hard times get worse and worse. That's how you feel. But you sing the opposite. You sing in defiance of what the reality is. If your world seems so bad, so terrible, and yet you're able in your heart to sing of a hope, then you're free. Do you see the way hope works? To hope in heaven is to defy all the darkness that's around you. And where there is darkness, there's no light. But where there's light, there's no darkness. You can't mingle light and darkness. One banishes, scatters the other. So when it's dark, it becomes an act of defiance to believe in the light. And I think sometimes we live through times in our own individual lives which are dark and lonely. And things happen, and sometimes you get a pile-up of bad luck, a pile-up of tragedies. You know, things beyond your imagination, in darkness, in evil, in wickedness, call it what you want. And it's very difficult to hope. It seems illogical to hope. And I suppose if you're in a war situation, it seems completely illogical to hope. And yet, it's where faith comes in, that you can defiantly hold a candle into the darkness. And I think that's what Christmas is about, you know. I think it's this defiance, it's this, like, enjoy the winter, enjoy the darkness, enjoy the way that, you know, it's darker every morning, the evenings come in quicker, it makes you tired, it makes you exhausted, it's hard to do work after 4 o'clock in the afternoon sometimes, I find. But you know that Christmas is coming, you know that this time is coming of joy and light in the house and candles and coloured lights and, you know, an abundance of food, and you're acting out a ritual which is going contrary to the darkness. It's going contrary to the winter. It's saying something of spring and summer and joy. We will have light. It might be our little cozy home. It might be our little house or little apartment. But we will have joy here at this table. And I think that you can't have that without having it inside. There's a place inside. Somebody asked me actually this morning, I was talking to a researcher on RTE, and you know, they were saying, where do you find peace? And I said, well, you go into your own heart and find it. And she said, how do you do that? I said, it's not rocket science. We all know that our deeper self is waiting for us inside. Just still the body, still the life. Stop all the agitation and movement that's around you and be still, be still. The psalmist says, be still and know that I am God. This is a beautiful idea. And when you know this peace in your heart, when you know this voice in your heart, and to me it's like being loved by a mother. It's just, I can't get away from that. I remember going to Częstochowicz town in Poland where they have this monastery, and the monastery they have this icon of the Black Madonna. It's a beautiful image. You'll get it on the internet if you want to look at it. But I went there to look at that real icon because I was in such despair, you know. It was the time where I was depressed, and I went through 2 years of it. And I think looking back on it, it may even have been caused by physical illnesses that hadn't manifested at that stage. Physical illnesses manifested later, and looking back, I realised that's probably what was giving me depression. But there are different reasons for it. It might be something in childhood, it might be your disposition, it could be anything, it could be a trauma that you've just come out of. But, you know, you're depressed. That's who you are. And I was there, it's 12 years ago, 13 years ago, and I came out of it. But one of the things I did at the time, and again, I look back and I realise, I went to this monastery in Poland, if you don't mind. Like, it was about 2 or 3 hours on a train, a slow train from Warsaw. And I went down there and I'd take a bed and breakfast, an Airbnb, for about 3 days. And every morning I'd go up into the monastery just to sit and look at the icon. And something in me was broken so that, you know, I couldn't get a language in my heart that said, please help me. I felt alienated. But gradually over maybe a few days or whatever, it began to work, it began to soften. It was like snow melting. And from that day onwards, I carried with me this sense of, there's someone waiting for you in your heart. There is your deeper self. If you stop agitating, moving around, listening to noise, if you be still and silent and listen to your own heart, and what you're hearing, what you hear in there is something from beyond the threshold. It's not that you're discovering your own real self as a self. It's you're discovering an otherness. You're discovering somebody else. And that otherness, it's a sense of relationship with another. You can't miss it. You can't fool yourself that if you're just in your own loop of self-obsession, then that's all you're in. But if you stay still enough, you'll begin to sense that within you, there is something like a personal relationship. There's like a being communicating with you. It's as if all the atoms in the universe were held together by a loving mother. And you know, why the mother of God? And the only answer is that the mother is the most strong, powerful image and experience that we all have of love from another, his mother. So it seems to me that, you know, the God who is transcendent, who's like, you know, beyond all ways that you can touch God, this mystery of being, how can it manifest itself intimately to us? It seems completely understandable to me that we humans began to use the idea of mother. And so Mary becomes elevated. She becomes crowned Queen of Heaven. She's like cosmically Mary in union with God. And she's our mother. So it gives us a kind of an imaginative or imaginal powerful channel and connection with God. We're not alone, folks. We're not alone. We're been-minded. And even in your darkest trouble, you're being minded and loved. And if you go into your own heart, you'll find the truth of that. I'm going to share with you now another memory, which is going back to about 2016, and it's of a lighter vein. It's hard to know what's the best cure for depression. I was in a vegetable shop in Sligo after Christmas when an old woman asked me, did I believe in vegetables? She was buying potatoes. I saw you on Tubridy blathering on about nothing, she said. Tubridy being, at the time, the host of the Late Late Show. Do you not like Tubridy? I wondered, hoping to deftly change the subject ever so slightly. It's you I didn't like, she said. You never said anything about vegetables. Now she was shouting. People like you need vegetables. This is because I was talking at the time about being depressed on the telly. Well, in fact, says I eat a lot of vegetables. Her fingers were floating over green beans and lumps of ginger. Ginger, she said, take that. And she shoved a lump of ginger root towards me. I don't want it, I said. And besides, that's not a vegetable. She was small and her hands were fat, and she counted her money onto the counter in 20-cent pieces when she was paying for her potatoes. What's your name? I wondered out loud. She was astonished, and she glared at me like I had asked her something ridiculous. Are you mad or what? She said. The guards wouldn't ask me that. And then she looked me in the eye and poked her finger into my chest. But, of course, she said, I know where you're from. And with that she left the shop, muttering to herself as she waddled down the street. Whatever about the vegetables, I'm certain that exercise is an enormous help to people who suffer from melancholy. So before I left Sligo that particular day, I purchased a treadmill, which had been on sale. I'd seen it earlier in the day. It was for half price. This is a big treadmill for walking on, and I have it now for 7 or 8 years, and it's just miraculous. It came in 2 large cardboard boxes, and that evening I assembled it in my studio. The following morning, I was treading away on the machine at a brisk pace and staring through the glass door when the electrician came around, and he stood outside the glass at the patio door laughing. I jumped off so fast before stopping the machine that I tripped and hit me head off the glass. You're like a hamster, he said, still laughing when I opened the door. But you'd need to be careful because you could crack your skull coming off that thing. He'd come to replace the clock on the central heating so that I could leave it on automatic when I was away in Poland, which I did 2 weeks later before heading for the airport. I was in the boarding area when I saw someone I didn't want to meet. I decided to slump down in a chair so that he might not see me. Please, God, don't let him come near me, I prayed. That's the way you get, you know, when you're depressed. You don't want to meet people. You see somebody in the distance and you think, oh, God, I don't want to meet that person. I'm not up to it, you know. I'm not emotionally up to it. And sometimes I get abused by people who they're only having fun. Like the woman in Sligo, she was having fun with me. Because if somebody sees you on television, they presume that the kind of, you're not real to them. You're kind of, you're an image that they've seen on TV and they want to bounce back at you. And that can be great fun. But it's not a personal encounter. So from my point of view, sometimes you have to be ready to be open with anybody, even a stranger who's going to be kind of bouncing jokes off you. But there I was in the airport and I was heading for Warsaw. And I saw this person. I thought, oh God, I don't feel like talking to them. So I had me head down. He's just someone I was jealous of in secondary school, to be honest. because he was so intelligent, and now he's very successful in his profession. And, well, I always feel inferior to him in his presence. And again, if you're depressed, it's a time that you can be very sensitive about other people's success. You know, it kind of, it bounces off you like their success highlights your failure in life. And that's how I was feeling. "What are you doing here?" he inquired, as if I shouldn't be at airports. "I'm waiting to board a plane," I replied meekly. "Why are you lying down? Is there something wrong with your back?" "I was just looking at the ceiling," says I. He looked up, but there was nothing remarkable about the ceiling. "There's nothing remarkable about that ceiling," he said. "No, no," I agreed. "There's not now. Isn't that amazing?" I was on the back foot, and he was becoming more and more like a school teacher. "Where are you off to?"
"Oh, where are you off to?"
"Oh, I'm off to Spain. Sunshine is absolutely essential at this time of year. What about yourself?"
Poland, I confessed.
He looked at me as if I was mad. "What are you going there for?" he wondered.
"Snow," I replied defiantly.
"Get some sun," he said. "It's the only effective remedy for depression."
And he walked off.
So he'd heard me on the radio, obviously, talking about depression, and that's the way he was dealing with it. It was abrasive, and it was probably true. I'd probably be better to go to some sunny climate and get a bit of vitamin D than be going to Warsaw in the snow. Anyway, there I was in the seat, on the plane, thinking of vegetables and sunshine and exercise, on my way to a world of snow, where I might be stuck in a small apartment, eating out of tins for a month. And before the door closed, a young woman plonked herself down in the seat beside me, wearing a silk scarf and a loose grey jacket. With remarkable ease, you know, that ease that students have when they wear vintage clothing and they look perfect because their bodies are so kind of, you know, slim and energetic. And I could see socks inside her boots, yellow socks. And I said to myself, there's a woman with a sense of humour. She closed her eyes and kept her earphones on for the entire flight until we were hovering over Warsaw. And I too closed my eyes for most of the journey, dreaming of what lay ahead. Long walks in the snow under blue skies, and large bowls of soup with beetroot, sour cream, and cabbage. I suppose it's like in that moment, I'm going into my own heart, you know. Because I see this beautiful woman, and this young woman, she's so lovely, and she's so self-contained, and she's so joyful in herself. And then when she gets on the plane beside me, she just goes asleep. But to me, it was like she went inside herself. Maybe she wasn't asleep at all. Maybe the 2 hours to Warsaw was a big long meditation. I don't know. I mean, she didn't snore or anything. She was just like eyes closed and her head back sideways against the back of the seat. But it was this sense of how beautiful she was and how she was living inside herself. And I think that sometimes you meet people like that, you know. Sometimes you meet people who are so present here that you feel that they're inside themselves. You see, you feel that you're only seeing the surface. There's a kind of a warm glow underneath their skin. There's other people you meet and they're like agitated, you know. They're kind of agitated. They're on the surface. Their emotions are on their sleeve all the time. And they seem agitated all the time. Or even happy all the time. Not just agitated. You meet people who are, they're happy all the time, but it's on the outside. You know, they can't stop talking. I'd be like that a little bit. Can't stop talking, you know, just flowing out, not even thinking what I'm saying. Full of exuberance or excitement. And those are people, like I say, you can feel them on the outside, but you're not sure that they have an inside at all. And I'm thinking of St. Paul, who says that idea, like, if I do not have love, I'm like an empty drum beating, an empty gong beating. And it's like an instrument that has an outside to it, and you bang the outside of it and it makes a lot of noise. But there's nothing inside. And St. Paul is talking about love. He's saying, if I have not love, this is what I am. And now I'm thinking that maybe there's a connection between love and the ability to go inside. And I don't know where that thought is leading me, but I know that, again, as I mentioned earlier, I was talking to a researcher in RTE earlier this morning, and she was saying, how do you find peace? And I said, you go inside yourself. You go into your own heart and you find it. And she said, how do you do that? And I said, well, it's not rocket science. If you stop the noise, so you turn off the telly, you turn off all the noise, you stop moving, you stop driving the car, you stop walking around, you just sit, you get your body to be still. And if you get your body to be still and you become conscious of your body, and then you have this sort of M50 motorway of thoughts running through your head. It's like flowing. There's about four lanes of thoughts going through your head. And you gradually try and empty them. You try and slow them down. You try and get to a stillness. You focus on a candle, or you focus on the wall, or whatever you want. And you become still. Now you can experience yourself going into your own heart. And in that heart, I'm saying, you can begin to experience that, like, there's another presence there. There's a kind of anotherness. You could cross this threshold within yourself where you feel, I am loved. And you begin to think about whatever is holding the whole cosmos together is like a personal, it's like a mother loving you. And that's a lovely place to be. Now here's the trick. If you're feeling this love on the inside, then it'll give you a compulsion to push it out to other people. So even when you're in that meditational mode, even when you're still, you can feel this, your heart, like there's an energy coming out of your heart for your friends. And you see them around you, you visualize them, and you just say, I love these people. And you'll really get somewhere, and you'll really become strong if you think about your enemies in that moment, so that you are actually, from your heart, sending them love. Now that's all on the inside. It's what you call prayer. It's on the inside. But once you get it on the inside, it will come out of you. And when you meet somebody who has that sense of an interior, it's an amazing thing that they're beautiful. It's amazing that, you know, beauty is not made on the surface, even though it is the surface that is beautiful. It is the lips and the eyes and the arms. It is the body of the beloved that is beautiful. It is a sensual, physical reality that is beautiful, male or female. But ultimately, it's not the actual flesh itself that makes you beautiful. It's what's inside. And if there is an inside, if there is, and you can feel it of people. I really do believe that you can kind of be present to somebody and feel they have a presence. They have an interior life. They are awake. Yeah, it's kind of love rapport when that happens. I really like it. So I'll just finish up with one more meditation. And it's going back into that time about 12 years ago, 12 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever, 2011, 2012, 2013, 14, I went through a bad period of depression. Why am I talking about it today? Because it's the 1st of December and because we're starting into preparing for Christmas. And Christmas, it comes with this darkness. It comes with the shortening day. It comes with the cold weather. It comes with the tiredness that can be on you and all sorts of dysfunction and family problems and worries and anxieties and money stress. Just the whole thing begins to implode. It's a darkness, right? And then inside it, you find this light. You find this peace. You find this defiance. And it's like believing in the resurrection. It's like believing God's presence in the little child. It's like believing that there is love always. And it scatters hatred. It's like just believing. You know, in every faith tradition, it's faith in a realm of beauty and love and compassion and being loved. Now, do you believe it or not? And if you can tip yourself over the threshold, even fake it until you make it. You know the way, do you ever go to a Christmas dinner and you're thinking, I'm going to hate this, right? But, you know, it's family, so we'll go anyway. And you sit down and they start off by opening champagne or a bottle of wine and you raise your glass and you're saying, to Christmas, happy Christmas, everybody. And you're thinking inside yourself, there'll be no happy Christmas here, you know. And you're feeling so negative inside yourself. And you feel negative even about people in the table and you're thinking they're only, you know, you're complicated. But you actually fake it. Some people would say you're a hypocrite. I wouldn't. I'd say that this is what ritual does. You fake it. You enact what sometimes your heart is not capable of. But by going through the ritual, you generate capability. So in this scenario that I'm describing, you come to the end of the evening and you've been there for 2 or 3 hours at the dinner table and you realise to yourself, do you know, that was a lovely evening. And you say things like, I didn't expect it to be so good. And you say things like, I've changed my mind about those people. They're my relatives and I was being negative, but gosh, they're lovely. You're driving home and you're saying to your partner, wasn't that a lovely evening? And you're saying it like you're surprised. Because you are surprised. Because you went into it thinking, oh, I don't like them. But you go through the ritual of engaging with people. And it turns out you do like them. And it turns out they lift your heart. Do you ever hear that phrase? Do you know where you say like, ah, now that lifted me heart. And I was there many times in winter 10 years ago where you'd feel so broken and so isolated in yourself and, oh, you'd go somewhere and you wouldn't be expecting anything good to come out of it and you'd come home thinking, you know, he lifted my heart. So the presence in him or her, the kind of joy that's inside them was kind of visible on the surface. There was something beautiful about them because they were joyful inside in their own hearts. And the only thing that could make them joyful is the only thing that can make any of us joyful, and that is the acknowledgement of God's presence in your heart. Sooner or later you come down to that. Soon, in whatever language, whatever big tradition of religious language that you use in all in the globe, it doesn't matter. Eventually it's all the one thing being said. God loves you. Even in the darkness. Even though it looks in physical terms like you will go down like me into the grave, into the destruction of death. There's something deep that will not perish. The deepest part of you will never perish, but will be in heaven forever, as it is today. Because if you recognize it and embrace it today, then you are now in heaven. You are now the light in the darkness. So it's amazing how all those rituals of Christmas about light in the darkness, it's amazing how those work on the inside and on the outside. That they say something true to me about my heart. And I ritualize them during Christmas, during the next 4 weeks. I ritualize them with my family, with the people I love. And that's Christmas to me. I'm going to finish with this just last meditation. From the winter of 2012, it was one of those mornings when nothing seemed to matter except the shortening day, the cloudy sky, and the falling leaves. As I counted my years again, and counted each aching bone in my body again, and fingered the flabby muscles on my arms. Economists on the radio were arguing about budgetary projections, the same old cut and thrust of a world where I don't fit in. That's how it begins, another wave of melancholy rising in the guts. A sense that I don't belong in the here and now. But then I saw an image on my computer screen of tiny pebbles lying in a gully on Mars. And according to the news report, the image suggested the existence of a river on Mars long ago. I'm always amazed at the vastness of space and the amount of people and planets that have already withered. And yet in this moment and in this day, I am alive. Isn't it amazing? I can never get my head round it, you know, that in all the moments in history that we can think about, go back, let's say in Christianity, go back 2,000 years, 2,000 summers, 2,000 winters, right? That's 2,000 times. But we're at this one. We always just happen to be here. We're always now. We're never back then. So what is it to be? What is it to connect our consciousness with now? The miracle of being able to say, I am alive now. The thought dispelled my melancholy, and I headed up the mountain for a walk, almost a gallop, flab swinging like a dozen handbags from me bones as I sweated along the miner's way. At the summit, I found the leg of a small bird in the dirt droppings of a seagull. I don't often examine the shit of birds, but it was an enormous gull, and he dropped his load just ahead of me on the mountain track near Spion Kop, where the coal mine used to be. Spion Kop is the name of a hill in South Africa where the Connacht Rangers once fought during the Boer War. It was a blustery morning of grey and white clouds tossed in the sky between me and Sligo Bay, which I could see in the distance, as the ugly windmill towers hummed above me and a hen harrier hovered between two propellers watching for prey. At the least, the windmills don't seem to bother them. A hare passed me running so fast that I could hear wind behind it and could see his terrified eyes. Then dogs came, ugly and straight at me, their eyes bulging, and finally a man slithered down a slope of mud and scree, a distraught man, maybe 50, and asked about the dogs. I was tempted to lie, to side with the hare, but he was too human in his bewildered state and tattered coat, and he clutched a sally rod to walk with, so I told him the truth. In fact, he was as lost as I was, an ageing lorry driver without a job and terrified of listening to the news or of life without antidepressants. When I returned to the fire, it was 11 a.m. Branches outside my window, laden down with rose hips, worried me as they knocked in the wind against the window pane. I was in my office trying to light the stove, and the smoke was coming down the pipe because the wind was from the northeast. It's only a northeasterly that goes down the pipe. So I climbed to the roof and covered the top with a bucket, but that didn't work. The room continued to fill with smoke. The ladder belonged to the builder, who looked in and asked if I was finished with it. "Jesus," he said when he saw the smoke, "you're like a kipper in here." Soon he will be finished his work on a new room. Then he must go off and build a shed for an old woman in her 80s, who still cuts her timber with a chainsaw. A woman who is old enough to remember the Messenger magazine, a little book of religiosity, the red covers of which girls once used to redden their cheeks long ago, before rouge was affordable on the mountains of Varigna. Of course, if I keep walking the hills, I'll become as thin as a kipper. And later, in the leisure centre, I was consoled by the fact that there were bigger bellies in the jacuzzi than mine. Bellies like gigantic eggs, so white and firm that I was tempted to poke them and see if they were made of skin or shell. And so another morning passed. I had avoided being drowned in melancholy. Yes, I had skimmed the waves, but I had also seen Mars on my computer, waterless, spinning about up there in complete silence. And just to know that I exist and Mars exists at the same time is somehow enough to keep me going. I think it's the mystery of being alive and being conscious, but also then allowing yourself to focus on something and not choosing it. Just whatever is accidental. It could be a stone on the footpath. It could be a bird on a branch, or it could be, in my moment, an image of Mars on my computer. And just to focus your here and now presence, your consciousness, on something else, it makes the connection complete. That what is within you is wonderful and amazing, and it's loved by God. But it really becomes connected when you look out. When you look at your child or your mother or father, when you look at your sister or brother, when you look at anybody in your family, and you realize we are alive in this moment. So that your consciousness, your being alive, is not just about you. You're not isolated in it. You know, I was saying earlier, you look at history, 2,000 years. Isn't it amazing that the moment we're in is all of the present moment? We're all in the one moment, here and now. But the thing is that you're never isolated in your own awareness, because once you look into the eyes of someone else, you realize you're sharing this consciousness with them. When you look into your own heart and you cross the threshold and feel that you're hearing in the silence the voice of God, the voice of the great mother who loves you, Mary, when you have that moment, but then look out at somebody else and you realize that they too are in the same moment. It's the one consciousness you're sharing. It's like, do you know what it says? Where two or three are gathered in my name, there also will I be. It's like that. It's like if you're conscious and you look into the eyes of somebody else who's conscious, you realize you're both sharing the one strange mystery of being alive, of being conscious. It's like you're both parts of the one whole, single consciousness. It's like you're both enveloped in God. Enveloped in the tenderness of Mary, the mother. That's love. That's light. That's what defies the darkness. That's Christmas. I hope the next 4 weeks are really deeply, wonderfully peaceful for you and for me. And thank you for being here. Bye-bye.